And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be, as the cameras start going off in the back. I'm here today to represent the interests of the American people, even my general and my various other generals, you know. We're making our military protection a little bit better for us, too. So thank you very much. Does everybody understand that? I think so.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this inspiring speech.
Hey, TrumpCast listeners. It's Jacob Weisberg, and I'm here with Ben Smith, the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. We're in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, where both of us just listened to an address by the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and we just came upstairs to this podcast studio, which is sort of in the attic of the Congress Center, which is the main Davos building, to talk about it. Ben, quick reaction. What did you think of the speech?
I mean, he came with a very clear message, delivered the message, did not wind up ranting and raving about some other random thing or stepping on his own message, which is unusual for him. It was probably the best I've seen him. I mean, I think he's somebody who, he always wanted to go to Davos. He's very happy to be in Davos. The president, or the founder of the World Economic Forum, laid it on incredibly thick in the intro about how great Trump was, and he liked that. So he was, you know, he sort of did what he actually intended to do, which was to come to a bunch of people who, of investors, and say America's open for business.
Yeah. I want to talk about the sort of Davos sycophancy towards Trump and the Trump people in a minute, but just staying on this speech, I mean, it was a word I would never have associated with Donald Trump before. He was disciplined. He had a written, carefully written speech, which he read off a teleprompter without deviation. Klaus Schwab, the head of the forum, did ask him a couple of very canned questions afterwards, which I think Trump knew about in advance. And Trump just didn't, I mean, he got booed briefly at one point when he used the phrase fake news, but it was almost a throwaway. But the rest of it was just very well-mannered, and something else you'd never say about Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is the speech that you hear the governor of South Carolina give when he's outside the state about how great it is to invest in South Carolina. It's a speech every politician gives a million times.
But he did express, I mean, Davos is the home of the globalists, and that's why the right has been so suspicious of it over the years. Of course, there's an anti-globalist left that's been very suspicious of Davos as well. But that political antagonism is why recent U.S. presidents have steered pretty clear of Davos. They haven't wanted to be associated with this idea. Trump is the most anti-globalist president we've ever had. Yet he comes, walks right into the center of it, and doesn't...
I mean, does he stand for anything? It's so hard to know, right? I mean, Steve Bannon, who was his most articulate ideologist, used Davos as a synonym for globalism and constantly referred to Davos. Trump, I think Davos was just always a party that he wanted to be invited to and never wasn't,
and now he gets to come on his own.
I'm not sure it's more complicated.
Yeah, but I mean, if globalism means anything, it's a consensus for action on climate change and the Paris Accords. It's free trade. It's pro-immigration and not necessarily open borders. That might be a caricature of it, but certainly a lot of...
But it's also the free movement of money. Yeah. I mean, in this context, probably more than any of those things. It's more than the free movement of labor. It's the free movement of money. And I think that's something Trump has common ground with these guys on.
And that really was his message, invest in America. I haven't heard Trump in that mode, but he was very much, as he's been doing in recent weeks, just bragging about the stock market, which he claimed was up 50% since he was elected. I haven't fact-checked that, but it might be in the ballpark. And then he said if the other party had won, it would be down 50%, which is a preposterous claim.
Counterfactuals are hard to check.
Was there anything in that room that you felt like was rubbing the wrong way or was a challenge to people there?
I mean, he was booed when he said fake news. Klaus was booed when he said nice things about Trump. It was not a pro-Trump room. Probably one in five people clapped at the end. But also, I think people who came in expecting to see a caricature, maniac, populist demagogue were positively surprised. There were, you know, scattered boos and hisses here and there. But there also had been rumors of a walkout. I think two people, including Joe Stieglitz's wife, walked out.
I didn't see them leave. I mean, there were a lot of people who sat down and didn't clap. I didn't clap, but, you know, it was...
It was respectful reception, basically.
He didn't give his opponents any real bait. I mean, it was a highly ceremonial occasion. They had this Swiss marching band in these Napoleonic costumes. It was kind of hilarious pomp and circumstance that, you know, when he walked in. But, you know, he did not say
anything racist.
That's for sure.
And in fact, actually, what I thought was really interesting, some of his advisors for most of the last year have been trying to get him to brag about how low black and Hispanic unemployment are, because they're not record, but probably lowest they have been in more than a decade. He has, for whatever reason, ignored that advice until the last few weeks, and he is now regularly talking about black and Hispanic unemployment, I think pipe dream that there's a way to build a political coalition that is class-based, you know, that he can kind of cut into kind of a class-based politics across race. It does not seem possible, but it's interesting.
So Trump's whole senior team is here. And again, I've never seen a turnout from an administration like this. Rex Tillerson just walked by me in the hall on the way up. His trade negotiator, Robert
Steve
Lighthouse.
Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary.
Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. And Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. How have they been received?
Basically rapturously. My impression is that everybody here thinks they're huge celebrities, and it's incredibly exciting to be in the same room as them.
Yeah. I mean, they're a little bit, he's being treated a little bit the way the Queen would be treated.
Yes,
you know,
totally.
Free of any content, he's
kind
a
of
huge
marveled
celebrity.
At. Yeah.
And I've been in a couple of sessions and heard little bits and pieces of these cabinet secretaries, and it's beyond normalization. I mean, they're being treated in a way that's actually sycophantic, as if this were not just normal, but... I mean, look, I think these business leaders are pretty enraptured with them.
Yeah, that's certainly the impression you get.
They like their tax cut. But these are people who didn't have...
Well, they also kiss ass professionally. So, I mean, I'm not sure they're enraptured or not enraptured.
Yeah.
They're playing the angles.
So it's not just that the tax cut has brought them around. I mean, everyone is making so much money now because of what's happened with markets. And markets have been going up for a long time, and they were going up for years before Trump and unemployment was going down. But, you know, the stupidest investor at Davos is getting rich. I mean, the people who are investing in Bitcoin are
getting rich.
Yeah.
Although I heard there's a bunch of, you know, there's a whole, like, a sub-theme here that of people who don't really know what cryptocurrency is talking about it a lot. But there are also, somebody was telling me, a lot of crypto, like millionaire crypto kids here who have spent most of the time skiing.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad choice. They've spend it while it lasts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is your first time here.
Yes.
What do you think about it? I mean, I think the first time you come, it's so weird, right?
Oh, it's really a very strange thing. I mean, I don't know. If you're a reporter in New York, you sometimes find yourself invited to some event where you walk into the room at Steve Rattner's house or something, and you're surrounded by all these sort of politicians and celebrities, and you're like, whoa, this is really interesting. It's not my world, but it's a good reporting opportunity. It's interesting. It lasts 2 hours, and this is that for 50 hours. It's quite strange.
Yeah. So there's huge news back home today, which is Trump apparently ordering or asking for the firing of Robert Mueller back in June.
Yep.
And the New York Times has that as a story. Has Trump had to deal with this here?
Somebody yelled a question about it at him as he kind of paraded through the hall, and he dismissed it as fake news.
Yeah. So you have all the world's press here, and they can't make him answer the question that's the biggest issue in American news and politics right now.
Right. Correct. Yeah. And when he's on stage, he's not asked it.
Yeah. How do you think that changes the equation? Now we know.
I mean, nothing changes, right? Like, I mean, the idea that this presidency was going to substantively change just seems like it's so bizarre that anyone floats that. Like, today was a good day. He had a good day. He's also in the middle of this very intense rolling crisis.
Yeah. I noticed there was some news. I mean, BuzzFeed, of course, as everyone knows, has published the Steele dossier. And there's been some litigation threatened and brought about that. But most recently, Michael Cohen, the Trump lawyer, who is at the center of the Stormy Daniels controversy, as well as...
Your friend and mine.
Yes, our friend, has threatened to sue you, actually sued you?
He filed suit.
Yeah. What on earth is Michael Cohen suing you about, and how could that possibly be anything other than a terrible idea for him?
I think those are questions you would have to ask Michael Cohen. I mean, we definitely feel very confident. We felt confident when we published that there was enormous public interest in this document. You know, this document was of enormous public interest. It seems substantially more obvious to everyone now. I mean, when we published it a year ago, there was a chorus of criticism, particularly from the White House, but also from journalists. And a year later, nobody, I think, is saying, gosh, I wish that thing had been kept secret. I wish we knew less about the Russia investigation.
Yeah, but Michael Cohen, as we found out in the last week, if we didn't already know, is a lawyer who plays this role of fixing things for Donald Trump. And he was the one who set up this corporation to make this payment to Stormy Daniels. That's very much in keeping with the impression you might get from the dossier. There might have been something factually inaccurate in the dossier about him, about the trip to Prague, but the dossier, in fact, doesn't claim to be 100% accurate. It's raw intelligence.
Yeah, and we certainly published it. Yeah, and we published it with that context. I mean, the day after Mr. Cohen sued us, the president said that he thought American libel laws were a sham. And I mean, we do not think the First Amendment is a sham. There's clearly some dispute.
Yeah, Christopher Steele does seem to be increasingly vindicated. I mean, I never thought the thing was fallacious or a hoax or anything like that, but I would say the evidence is mounting that the percentage of the dossier that's accurate has continued to climb since you first published it.
Yeah, there have been just specific claims, particularly some of the stuff around Paul Manafort that was borne out. And, you know, and I think when you look back to when he was writing that in the summer of 2016, John Cipher wrote this recently. I mean, the broad thrust of the claim, which is that Russia was engaged in this kind of broad-spectrum campaign to undermine the U.S. election and support Donald Trump, has obviously been vindicated. I don't know if you saw this incredible Dutch report yesterday.
No.
That the reason the U.S. knows this is that Dutch intelligence had hacked into the computers of the programmers doing the hacking on the Russian side and then had also managed to open up the security camera in the room where the hacking was going on and watch them for several years.
Really?
Yes.
So we had a spy cam on the spies.
Yeah.
If this is true. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if that's not cyber war. I don't know what is.
Yeah. It's from a lot of interesting directions to go there.
So, final word. Trump takes Davos. I mean, this was as close to a all out success for him to come here, as unlikely an idea as it might have seemed, as it could have been. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it points to the sort of end of the Bannon era and the sense that there was this kind of ideological clarity that Bannon tried to impose and that we imposed on Trump that never really suited someone who'd been a vacuous celebrity for his whole career.
Yeah. I mean, it may be that simply his view on immigration, which in some ways is a more consistent view for him.
Well, it's because he's been consistently racist through his career.
Right, and if you extend it, but if you extrapolate that to a...
But I'm sure a lot of people here at Davos are also racist, so you know.
No doubt. But what I'm saying is that racism or being against immigration is a proxy for anti-globalism, and as you point out, there's a lot more to globalism.
Yeah, I'm not even sure it is, right? I'm not sure. I mean, I think that when the Americans accurately say that a lot of these European leaders aren't, you know, would never allow the levels of immigration that the U.S. has allowed. Like, they've got a point, right? I think the U.S. has been outside the global norm in being so open to immigration. And, I mean, you certainly see that in Europe.
So you're fine with Donald Trump globalist. Do you think that's a completely plausible interpretation?
I just don't think it's worth trying to impose ideological frameworks on the guy. He's reactive. He's like a person walking down the street staring at a mirror.
Yeah. And here he can brag about the stock market with people who absolutely share his view.
I mean, he likes money, that is for sure.
I've been speaking to Ben Smith of BuzzFeed. Ben, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Jacob.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold. Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Be sure to check back with us next week. We're going to be talking a lot about the Mueller investigation. We're going into detail. I want to thank Martin Lonisser of Eurovision, who is our engineer here in Davos. And I want to thank the World Economic Forum for providing a great studio for us. Jason DeLeon produced today's show. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.